pants today.
Love them.
On sale, men's section, Old Navy.
I saw them out in the kitchen. I thought they looked cute.
Let me tell you, I was perusing the men's section that was on sale because it was where the women's section used to be. And I saw these pants and I was like, they're so cute. And I tried them on. I was like, they fit great. And they have real pockets on the butt.
Right. Which girl pockets don't exist on the butt.
I like, we're getting better with the front pockets. We have front pockets now.
Sure.
But I need a butt pocket because I put my phone. And here's how designed they are for a modern lifestyle. The left butt cheek has a button. The right butt cheek does not, because they know that that's where everybody puts their phone.
And the other one is right for the wallet cheek, so it doesn't get stolen. Duh.
Genius.
Duh.
I was like, why are we not given the same courtesy? So now I'm like, I'm going to the men's section every time to find more pants.
Hey, because do it up.
I love them.
Especially since like boyfriend pants are in right now.
Exactly.
So much in.
Mm-hmm. So anyways, that's my news for the week.
Perfect. The table in here smells like pickles. We just did an interview. I spilled half my pickle martini. It's going to be fine.
Yep. Everything's
good. At
least
it's not summer. It would be like smell like crazy.
I told Casey, I was like, we have to get, because we got the puppy in the winter, you know, and I was like, we've got to get Stanley Steamer in here for the dining room rug, because that's the rug that the puppy peed on.
I have a carpet cleaner.
I know you do. So yeah. I was thinking about borrowing that, and then if it doesn't work for the smells, because like, I don't know. I'm just like so nervous about springtime coming, and you know this. Springtime comes, all the bad smells in your house
right
suddenly appear.
Right, because we don't have air conditioning to neutralize.
Exactly.
Like everybody else. Our house just bakes in the sun.
It's like being in an easy bake oven of sin.
Dog piss. Great. Welcome to the show.
This is Herstory.
On the Rocks.
With Katie.
And Allie.
This is a podcast where we talk about famous women in history.
We talk about good women and bad women and fictional women and non-fictional women from all times and places, because women have nuance.
But keep in mind, we're drinking the entire time.
And we're not historians. We Google. I had help from Tim Burton this week. It was such a treat. But we definitely don't know all the details. And when we mess up, just let us know.
Yeah. We love corrections. We really welcome them.
And I will say, I always forget to say this. I totally appreciate when you guys listen to an episode and then send us links to articles of just like further information.
Yeah.
That's like so cool. Or like you stumble upon something on the internet. I know sometimes I don't like respond to every single one, but it is so cool to just like pop open my phone and be like, oh, somebody else is now interested in this woman.
Yep.
So thank you. That's the point of the show.
Yeah, it really
is. The more times we say women's names, the less we forget them.
You know what's funny is I have now been keeping a running tab of like women to cover, because like I'll hear about a cool woman and then I'll like be like, oh, we should cover her on the show, and then I totally forget about
right.
it. So now I just like, I'm in the habit of like writing it down like immediately,
right?
So and now it's like
we have such a long list again.
I know, it's
plus all the requests.
Yes,
crazy time. Okay.
Anyways,
but you're so busy steaming your own carpet.
Yes. You're cleaning your carpets, getting ready for spring, and so you have your headphones on. Your phone is in the other room because you are focused.
And it won't fit in your pocket.
No, because you have women's pants.
Way to tie this all together. God, it's like it's scripted.
And we know that you want to know what these women look like if you've never heard of them before. Maybe
sure.
they're a mystery to you. Mm-hmm. So we're going to describe them so you have a picture in your head while we're telling their story. We're going to get a little
physical.
Allie, who are you doing and what does she look like?
I'm doing Margaret Keane, and Margaret is a slender woman with a long face. She sported short blonde, like curly hair most of her life that grayed with age. She was just long and thin. Mm-hmm. There's like not really a better way to describe her. She had long arms. She had long legs. She looked great in a turtleneck, which is close to impossible. And later in life, she wore sometimes these really big, thick rimmed glasses that kind of made her look a little bit like her art. And she's most famously portrayed in the biopic about her life by Amy Adams.
Mm, exciting.
Called Big Eyes.
I am doing Adrian Shelley. Adrian is a gorgeous, petite, very 90s woman with thick, dirty blonde hair that was typically long with face framing bangs. people often said that she looked like a baby doll. She was very pale, had a round face, large lips, and a big toothy smile. She had big doe eyes, long dark eyebrows, a button nose, and big round cheeks. And if she's out on the streets, she can typically be seen in hip clothes that would have been very in, you know, for a woman in her 20s to 30s. But in her most famous role, she is wearing thick black framed glasses and a blue waitress uniform and chunky white shoes. And that's what Adrienne looks like.
Yeah, she's quite cute.
She's so cute.
She's adorable. She's like really one that like when you stop and see pictures, you're like, wow.
Yeah. So do you want to know what you're about to drink?
This drink, let me tell you, I would like stop and like if I saw it on a menu, I would like stop and be like, I have to order this. And I like hate day drinking, but this is like, yeah, great.
I hope it tastes good. This is new liqueur alert. I bought banana liqueur for
Miss
this.
Krista. Sorry, you're expanding your bar cart.
So this is my second pie-based cocktail of the season. So I did a cherry pie, and now I am doing banana cream pie.
You should just make it. You know what? We should theme a season once about cocktails. We've never done that.
We've never done that before. That would be fun.
Look at that brainwave. Okay. Maybe our 21st season.
Maybe. When we're legal. So this is rum, banana liqueur, heavy cream, vanilla simple syrup, and a dash of cinnamon. So you shake it all up, top it with whipped cream, and you crumble Nilla wafers over top, and you garnish it with a Nilla wafer. And I chose a dried banana slice. Or a plantain
My
chip,
favorite
you might call
treat.
It, because Target didn't have bananas today.
Ooh,
so
okay.
Cheers.
What's it called again?
Nilla. Oh, Indie Darling. I thought you meant Nilla wafer.
Wow.
Sorry, the cocktail's called Indie Darling.
Indie Darling.
It is so nice.
It tastes like banana cream pie. Uh-huh. It's exactly like a banana cream pie. I can barely get to it, but this is
so much whipped cream.
This is all I want from now on the rest of my life. I'm going to eat this banana chip. It's going to be noisy, and I'm not sorry about it, listeners.
Well, also the banana chip is like a nice, salty mid-cocktail snack for you if you're like, this is too... And it's really not even that sweet. I'm
no, it
surprised.
Isn't. I like it so much.
Inside scoop, we have banana cream pie every year for my dad's birthday.
Yes.
And I look forward to it.
It's so good.
Every year.
Yeah.
And there was a lot going on with the Ravens in the playoffs, and like Casey and I were away and producer was away. So like I didn't get my banana cream pie.
I got
mix.
It. I was
you
there,
got
girl.
It. I'm kind of furious. So this is my rebuttal to that.
Oh my gosh. Well, just all we have to do is ask your mom to make it and she'll make it. She's like a saint.
Anyways, what do you know about Adrienne Shelley?
She was in the, media world. Mm-hmm. I think she did a little bit of acting, a little bit of writing. But I think she's mostly famous for The End of Her Life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to give any spoilers for people who don't know the story, but I'm pretty sure that it's a fairly tragic and fairly suspicious type of death.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a Natalie Wood situation, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of that, my sources are Moms and Mysteries.
Same
a
place.
Great podcast. Right? Yeah, they covered the story, and I think that they also had the same source as I did, just Wikipedia. And there's a documentary that her husband made of her called Adrienne. Absolutely gorgeous. It's on HBO Max. Highly recommend it.
Mm.
Okay, let's get into it. Adrienne Shelley was born Adrienne Levine in Queens to Sheldon Levine and Elaine Longbaum on June 24th, 1966. She had two brothers and grew up on Long Island, where from an early age, she had a desire to perform. She started when she was about 10 at Stage Door Manor Performing Arts Training Center and immediately had talent scouts trying to sign her. But her father said no. He said he didn't want his daughter to grow up a dysfunctional child star. So she stayed at the local level, honing her craft. But unfortunately, her father died when she was just 12 years old.
Oh, sad.
And this had a huge impact on her. She talks a lot. Like, one of the great things about the documentary is, like, her daughter, who is now, like, I want to say she's, like, 16 maybe, is reading her mother's journal entries. And she talks a lot in her journal from this time about, she's like, I didn't know that, like, the grief would just keep on coming. Mm. Like, this had a really big impact on her. But she kept with her work, and she made her professional debut in a summer stock production of the musical Annie when she was still a student at Jericho High School in Jericho, New York. She enrolled in Boston University, majoring in film production, but dropped out after her junior year and moved to Manhattan. This is a big decision for her because, like, everybody was like, you have 1 year left. Like, just stick it out.
What a crazy time to move.
I know.
I mean, I feel like that is the time when you can quit and make it big. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of people who leave college in the dust because of an opportunity.
She didn't have one.
Oh, she's just going.
She just had a gut feeling.
Girl in the big city. Girl in the big city.
She was just like, this is the right move for me. She was like, she really felt like I learned everything I can from school. Another year is just going to delay me getting my big shot.
Wow. Just around the river bend. No Cocoum for her.
And you know what? She was right. So she moved to New York. She started pursuing an acting career, and she mainly landed roles in indie films. And even when she was in high school and she started really, like, going after the acting thing, she would refer to herself as Adrian Shelley because her father's name was Sheldon. So it was a little nod to him.
That's cute. When I, like, see her name sometimes, like, I think of her as, like, as related to Mary Shelley. And I'm like, that's not who she is. But no. It is spelled the same, right? It has the E in it towards the end. No, it's spelled different.
Yes. Hmm. Interesting.
Well, maybe that's just because I don't know how to spell that.
No, I was spelling it that way. And then I was like, wow, there's, like, not much on her. And then I was like, oh, wait, I'm spelling her last name wrong. So anyways, her breakthrough came when she was cast by independent filmmaker Hal Hartley as the lead in The Unbelievable Truth in 1989 and then Trust in 1990. This solidified her as an indie darling, what some consider an actress like Michelle Williams to be. Mm. And this made her a very hot commodity in the independent film scene. People were writing articles about her. She was on the cover of magazines. It was like she was the it girl of, like, the cool kids, right? You know,
the overnight success punk indie film girl.
Exactly.
And a dream of everyone.
Yes. And for the next 20 years, she capitalized on this success, starring in dozens of films. But when she became kind of disillusioned with the movie scene and the roles she was getting, you know, she was, like, really frustrated because she was either getting, like, doe-eyed innocent girl or, like, doe-eyed innocent girl who was secretly a sex pot. And there was even a movie that she did. And so independent films will get, like, bought by bigger companies, you know, for wider release. And the one film she did was bought by Harvey Weinstein's company. And he looked at the film and he was like, I like it, but that girl should be naked more. Like, can we add some nude scenes with her? And she was like, no.
Well, we all know how Harvey Weinstein turned out. It must be so. You have to be so careful early in your career in acting, just because, you know, you can pick a wrong role and it can, like, transcend your whole career. There's some people who, like, end up getting past it, but it seems like every actress, actor, female actor that we talk about is, like, really struggles with being typecast.
Yeah. It's such a hard bubble to get out of. Like, even now, you know, like, you have people who spend, like, again, we talk about her all the time, but Judy Greer spent so many years cast as the exact same character.
Oh, yeah.
Like, every movie she was in.
Kirsten Dunst hasn't acted in 2 years because she says people keep, like, casting me as a tragic mom.
Yeah.
And I just am not going to take those roles because I'm, like, 35. She's like, what are you talking about?
Oh, my gosh. So she's becoming kind of disillusioned. And so she was like, you know what? Why don't I go back to the stage?
Sure.
So she goes, does a lot of off-Broadway stage productions across Manhattan. She does some TV shows, classic Law and Order. And then she started her own stage production company because, as she said in her journals, she goes, Adrian, just admit to yourself that you are a control freak and the only answer to your problems is to write and direct the whole damn thing yourself.
If you're type A and you know it, Clap your hands.
She was finally admitting. She was like, because she was like, I'm always writing about how, like, I'm in this production and the casting is all wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. I could do it better. And she's like, okay, well, then I have to fucking do it then. I just have to start doing it.
It's like when somebody asks me to help decorate for a party and they're like, what can I do to help? And I'm like, nothing.
Everything that touches the light is mine. Don't move a thing.
It's like, I don't mind planning parties with you. You're a good party helper.
Thank you.
You have taste. I don't. So it works well. I'm all kitsch.
Yep.
Kitsch only.
We actually, if we had like a comedy duo, I think it would be called Kitchen Eclectic.
Yes.
Actually,
thank God.
That'd be a good name for this podcast. Oh. If it didn't have a well-established name already.
Get rid of it. New name.
Kitchen Eclectic.
Starting the show over.
I like that.
We got to get friendship bracelets.
Anyways. So, in 1994, she wrote and directed her first short film, Urban Legend. Then she went on to write and direct Lois Lives a Little, which is looks really cute. It's about, like, this, like, elder, like, Jewish woman who's, like, in a Mahjong game with, like, her old Jewish friends, and she reads romance novels.
Again,
and,
perfect.
You know, I just, like, I love the plot of this movie, and she's like, I need to live a little. And then she wrote and directed Sudden Manhattan, also in 1997. And then The Shadows of Bob and Zelda in 99. In 2001, she went on a date with a man named Andy Ostroy. He was chairman and CEO of a multi-million dollar marketing firm, and he was highly respected in his field.
An MMF.
Uh-huh. She told People that she met him at a political fundraiser.
Oh.
But she actually met him on Match.com.
Internet dating?
In 2001.
That would have been seen as so scandalous back then.
That's why she didn't tell anyone.
My teacher in high school met her boyfriend internet dating, and, like, it got around on the gossip pool, and everybody was like, she's gonna get murdered. Oh, my God. They're married. Still, happily. She's my friend on Facebook.
Yeah. I know so many people. A friend of mine, you know, some guy she met on, like, Hinge.
My brother and sister-in-law met on online.
One of the places.
I don't know one of them.
On the wide internet.
On the www dot.
Allie, sorry. Everybody, buckle up.
We haven't seen each other for 2 weeks. Well, we haven't recorded for 2 weeks. We're going wild.
I drove by a place the other day, and I read the name of this place to be Wawawa Wings.
Did it have three W's?
Yes. But it was supposed to be Worldwide Wings.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And
that's funny.
And I was like, what a crazy name. Wubba Wings? It wasn't that. It was Worldwide Wings.
No, but I like yours better.
I like mine better,
I
too.
Like your way better.
So, yeah, I was cracking up, and I was like, I got to take a picture for Casey.
www.ings is what it should have been.
Dot. Everyone's confused.
Also, I'm confused about the at symbol. Like, it's always been on the keyboard, but the internet hasn't always existed. So talk to me about why.
Wait, what?
The at symbol above the two? Like, why was it there?
Oh, because it's slang.
Yeah, but why was it there?
For slang? I don't know. Anyways.
Okay.
Okay. And maybe it wasn't always there. Who knows?
It was.
Okay.
I asked Peggy.
Who actually is, like, very good at computer science.
Yes.
And I love that.
She's
about your mom.
Come true.
I love that about your mom. Okay. So they meet on Match.com, and she tells him they could go on a 5-minute date. And he asks,
in heaven or just
why?
Date?
He was like, why 5 minutes? She goes, well, if I hate you, I'll probably figure it out in the first 5 minutes. And she goes, and then we don't have to waste a whole bunch of time on the rest of the date.
Love it.
So she's like, I'm going to give you 5 minutes and we'll see where it goes.
Talk about pressure.
The 5-minute date lasted 5 hours.
Nice. I was going to say, we should do that with sex. I'm going to give you 5 minutes. Prove yourself to me and go.
And go. Setting the timer now. No pressure. The 5-minute date lasted 5 hours.
That's adorable.
And they married just a year later in 2002. She said in her vows, this was the mad, crazy love affair she had been waiting for her whole life. Which is really sweet, because a lot of her friends and family were talking about how, because she was this indie darling. She's this cute little girl that, like, you know, men would come in and they would want to, like, very much control her. You know what I'm saying? And it's like,
wow, not all men, everybody.
Not all men. Obviously not Andy. But, like, a lot of guys would, like, want to overpower her. And they were like, it was so frustrating because, like, Adrian is a huge believer in love. You know, she's a Charlotte. She would sometimes talk and she would be like, I know that he's out there. She's like, my guy is out there and I know he is. So, like, this is just like, I'm just waiting for him. You know, like, she just believed in it so hard, which is so difficult, like, especially in a city like New York in the early 2000s, late 90s. Like, as Carrie Bradshaw said, romance is dead.
Yeah.
at this time. So when they found each other, they just fell head over heels. They loved each other so much. And then the next year in 2003, they welcomed their daughter, Sophie, who was the absolute light of their lives. And while she was pregnant, she started writing a movie called Waitress. So the plot of the movie is that Jenna Hunterson is a waitress living in the America South, and she is trapped in an unhappy marriage with her controlling and abusive husband, Earl. She works in Joe's Pie Diner, where her job includes creating inventive pies with unusual titles, usually inspired by her life, such as the Bad Baby Pie she invents after she finds out that she is pregnant and she does not want to be. Jenna longs to run away from her dismal marriage, and she is slowly accumulating money to do so. And she finds out that there is a pie contest in a nearby town which offers $25,000. And her husband won't let her go, but she knows that this is her ticket out. All the meanwhile, she begins having an affair with her doctor. And of course, she is accompanied by two quirky waitresses, Becky, played by Cheryl Hines, who many may know from Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Dawn, who is played by Adrian herself. And Jenna is, of course, played by the amazing Carrie Russell, who was just coming off of her Felicity fame. So this is a big get. Adrian worked hard on all of her projects, but Waitress was truly a passion project for her. She not only wrote, directed, and acted in it, she also was involved in all of the minute details, such as hair, wardrobe, set design, lighting. She wanted it to look exactly as she envisioned it, and she was going to get it done. The pictures of her, like, in her costume, then, like, rushing around to go look at the monitor are
direct the
incredible.
Movie.
And
I can't imagine that.
I can't either. Like,
I couldn't be a good director or a good actor, let alone both at the same time.
And one of the things that she envisioned, and this came true, was having her daughter, Sophie, come in at the very end. She played Jenna's 2-year-old daughter when the film flashes forward. So if you're familiar with the movie, the little girl at the end is Adrian's real daughter, Sophie. Aww. It's so cute. And another nod. So one of the reasons I chose banana cream pie for this cocktail also is that one of the pies she creates is like, you know, like, I'm having an affair with my doctor, you know, banana cream pie. Mm-hmm. And she puts a whole banana in and she goes, hold the banana. And the waitress outfits they're wearing at the end are yellow and they're sunshine and they're bright, which is so how Adrian was. Mm-hmm. Like, she just brought a lot of sunshine into whatever space she was in. And it was really important for Adrian to show in the film a woman working hard throughout a pregnancy and motherhood, because she was also doing that herself. And I think that's a really powerful thing, because she was, like, respecting the work of a waitress as much as she respected her work as a filmmaker, which, like, a lot of people are like, oh, you work in a diner, like, big deal. And it's like, actually, it's really fucking hard.
Yeah.
Like, and she really took pride in her label as a working mom, because when she became pregnant, even though she had wanted to have kids her whole life, she was really scared. And she was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do both. And like a lot of women, she was worried that having a baby was going to change her as a person, who she was. She was like, I don't want to lose myself when I have a baby, which is such a big fear that I think a lot of women have, that isn't talked about very often. And she especially, like, she was like, and a big part of me is my career. She's like, am I just going to be so focused on this by, that I lose my creative vision, that I'm not going to be able to do this? But after watching a final cut of the film, she turned to her friend and she said, see, you don't have to choose. Society wants us to feel like we have to choose between career and family, but we don't. So she always said that the movie is really a love letter to her daughter and how she changed her life in the best way possible, even if it scared the shit out of her.
Parenthood's crazy.
Is this also like hitting some heartstrings? Because your daughter turned 14 this week.
Yeah. it's banana. I can't believe I'm old enough to have a 14-year-old. Yeah. I don't feel old enough to have a 14-year-old. And it's really nice because my 14-year-old's a really, like, she's a good friend of mine. Like, so I really, like, I enjoy being a mother, and I also feel like I grew up with her, you know? Because, you know, I was 23 and had two kids. You know, that's fucking insane. That's insane. So, like, I just kind of grew up with them, and, you know, producer travels a lot, so it was just us girls. So I'm, like, so proud of that. They're going to high school next year. I'm like, oh, my gosh.
I know. I was actually talking to Casey a lot about that this week because, like, I feel like because, like, I mean, you were 23. I was, like, 14. Yeah.
We all grew up together. It's crazy.
And I was talking. I was like, you know, I feel kind of guilty that, like, I feel like now that Felix is here, he's our youngest. He was born in November.
He's a baby.
He's a baby baby. And, like, I feel like I have a chance to, like, be a better aunt because, like, I'm a more, like, responsible adult. Like, I couldn't be the go-to for Caroline and Eliza because I was a literal teenager.
I was a teenager.
You were in high school, Katie. And, like, it feels good to, like, be, like I feel like I'm the go-to person for this baby, and that feels amazing, you know. And I don't know. So lots of emotions. I cried a lot this week.
Right, but, like, don't shit on yourself for being 14 when I had children.
It was my fault, Allie.
You still absolutely helped out so much. What are you talking about? You babysat. You came over all the time. That was the biggest thing for me. I needed to not feel empty inside.
Yeah.
So people coming over to be with me helped me get through my 20s.
Yeah.
So that was what you could do.
Yeah.
And you did it. You're welcome.
So Adrian is truly living her best life. She loved her family. Her movie that she worked so hard on was going to premiere soon. And she is, like, thinking about all these other ideas that she has. So she even had her own separate office in, you know, Greenwich Village that, like, she could, like, get work done on. You know, like, she's like, I have a house and an office? Like, this is crazy in New York. Like, she's living the dream. But it was this little apartment office in Greenwich Village where all of her dreams would come to an end. Adrian Shelley was found dead at approximately 5:45 p.m. on November 1st, 2006, just mere hours after she got done throwing a huge Halloween party for her daughter. And there's video of it. Literally the night before, her husband was like, I was having the best night of my life. Sophie is dressed like Cinderella, and they're busting a pinata open, and they're having the best time. And he said, and by the end of the next day, he's like, I was living my worst nightmare. So Andy had grown concerned because she hadn't checked in with him all day after he dropped her off that morning, and she wasn't answering her messages and her emails and his calls. And he was like, that's, like, very weird. So he was on his way to an event, and he asked his friend, he goes, can we just check in on her really quick? He was like, I'm worried. And he goes, yeah, of course. So he asked the doorman to let him into the apartment, and the doorman says, of course. They go upstairs. He opens the door. Andy goes in, and the doorman hears him screaming, crying, shouting, no, no, no. To Andy's horror, he found Adrian's body hanging from a shower rod in the bathtub with a bedsheet around her neck. She was 40 years old. They obviously called the police, and after a quick scan of the scene and the autopsy confirming that she died from neck compression, her death was ruled a suicide. When Andy heard the conclusion, he said, absolutely not. He said, that's simply not possible. He insisted that his wife was happy in her personal and professional life, and she would never, ever leave her 2.5-year-old daughter motherless on purpose. So after days of protesting, the police finally conceded, and they took a second look. And of course, when they looked further, they noticed that money was missing from her wallet. The door was unlocked. She had defensive wounds on her hands and arms. And they found a foreign sneaker print in the gypsum dust, which is drywall dust, on the toilet seat lid beside where her body was found.
Hmm. Sounds like somebody staged something.
Mm-hmm. But of course, the truth moves much slower, and tabloids started printing that Adrian had died by suicide. Andy tried to stop the runaway train that was the story, but he still didn't have any answers to what really happened. So it's just kind of his word going up against like what everyone thought was this very clear evidence. And it was really frustrating because, you know, he was trying to tell them it's not a murder, and the police are like, well, we are looking, and they're like, well, all right, if we're going to entertain you for a minute, we're going to check to see, because like the footprint can't be from anyone but like someone who was just there on the day of the crime scene. So they literally checked every EMT, firefighter, every person that came through that day. And the footprint that was found on the toilet seat was still not matching anyone. And they were also actively ignoring the question, why was there drywall dust in her bathroom to begin with? I mean, she wasn't doing any renovations in the unit. An EMT wouldn't track drywall dust in. Like, they're just not looking at it as if they did. Like, they just want to think it's a suicide and close the case.
They're taking the, like, you hear a neigh, it's a horse, not mm-hmm. a zebra.
Exactly. Well, turns out, just a floor away, there was a construction crew working on another apartment. They looked at who was working that day and who would have access, and they soon had a name. Diego Pilco, a 19-year-old construction worker from Ecuador. They went to talk to Diego, who was living in a friend's basement in Brooklyn, and they quickly found the sneaker that matched the print. Diego was arrested on November 6th. During the interrogation, Diego described what had happened. He claimed that when Adrian demanded the construction noise be kept down because she was trying to work and he was being too loud, he threw a hammer at her. Didn't hit her. He goes, it just like was like, I just like threw it near her. But then he got afraid that she might make a complaint and that could result in his deportation since he had immigrated to the United States illegally. He said he then followed her back to her apartment, and when he walked in, she slapped him. And when he grabbed her at the apartment door, he punched her in the face, knocking her to the ground where she hit her head and fell unconscious. Believing he had killed her, he then hanged her to make it appear as a suicide. Police were glad to have a confession, but the story wasn't really adding up, since there was no trauma to her head, and there was no drywall dust on her shoes, which she certainly would have had if she had gone down to the apartment and yelled at him about the noise. So when they approached him with this, he finally told them the truth. He said that he was returning to work after lunch when he noticed her returning to her apartment in the elevator, and he decided to follow her and rob her. He said he waited on the landing of Shelley's apartment as she entered and left the door open, and he intended to steal from her purse. He had been stealing from apartments that he was working in for a while to send money back home because he had a $13,000 debt back in Ecuador that he was trying to help out with.
Yeah.
When Shelley caught him, she threatened to call the police, and that he didn't speak English, and that was the only word he heard was police, which he couldn't have because he was there illegally.
Mm-hmm.
So he grabbed the phone, covered her mouth to quiet her screaming. He started choking her. She fell to the ground, and he saw that her mouth was blue. She was dead. Pilco found a bed sheet and tied it around her neck and strangled her, and then dragged her to the bathroom where he hung her body from the shower rod to make it look like a suicide. And that's what actually happened.
This is like a crime of convenience.
Yeah.
Like, this is not, there's no target.
No. He was trying to steal money. She caught him, and he just acted, and he did the wrong thing. Like, you can just see every step happening in your head and just, like, the fury of it. And then it's like, then there's a dead woman. And he's like, well, it's just horrible. It's horrible. So he confesses. And they get the real story. But the prosecutors were worried that if they went to trial and he goes up on the witness stand and he goes back to his first story of, like, yeah, she was complaining, I didn't mean to do it, I just pushed her and she hit her head and there was an accident, they were so worried that he was going to get off on a lesser charge and only serve, like, 3 to 5 years for an accidental murder, even though the evidence was there. There's no head wound. The evidence supports their story. The family was in so much grief and mourning, they didn't want to take the chance. And the defense was also equally worried that they would hand down the harshest sentence possible and he would get a life without parole. So both sides came together and agreed on a plea deal. Diego pleaded guilty to first-degree manslaughter, and he was sentenced to 25 years in prison without parole and without the possibility to appeal. And that is a really important thing to note, because if there are no appeals processes, then the family does not have to get dragged back into court every couple of years.
Over and over again.
To tell the courts why he should keep. And, like, the family was so overwhelmed by grief that the idea of, like, him getting 25 years and them not having to do that and just having a sure thing. And, like, and also not having to go through a public trial.
Oh,
like,
absolutely. I totally understand settling out of court. Yeah.
Like, and I honestly think it was, like, the right choice for them. Like, just to, like, have it over and done with. And
justice,
like,
has been served and peace of mind has been afforded.
Shelley's husband and family members said that they would never forgive him. Andy Ostroy said of Pilko, "You are nothing more than a cold-blooded killer," and that he hoped he would rot in jail.
Mm.
Now, I want to make it clear that Diego being in the U.S. illegally does not mean that this was bound to happen and this is why we need to shut down the borders. I mean, even Andy Ostroy, who was obviously in an incredible amount of pain, always makes a point to say that.
Right.
He said he had just as much of a chance as, like, killing Adrian than, like, a person who grew up down the street.
Right.
You know,
doesn't matter.
It was just, you know, most people who come to the U.S. are here for a better life, and, like, sometimes they do bad things because all people do bad things.
Yeah.
You know, and Andy does make it a point to, like,
equal opportunity violence.
Exactly. But we do mention his immigration status because it is a part of the case, and it also affected the lawsuits that followed.
Well, and the way he reacted.
Yes.
And
exactly.
The language barrier. There's a lot that goes
There's a lot going on. And that was why, you know, Andy sued the contracting company that he was hired by, because he said, you know, Adrian would still be alive if you hadn't hired them. And then he sought to hold the owners and the management of the building that she died in, like, liable for Shelley's murder, saying, like, if you had, like, Andy was just mad at everyone.
He's in pain.
At the time, he's in so much pain, and he was just like, someone has to be held responsible. You know what I'm saying? It's like, so he's just trying to sue everyone, but the cases just didn't go anywhere. On July 7th, 2011, the lawsuit was dismissed by Judge Lewis York, and, you know, he determined that Andy had not established legal grounds to hold the contractor liable, writing, "While the court sympathizes with your loss, plaintiffs have not presented sufficient legal grounds upon which to hold Bradford liable for Pilko's vicious crime." He also said that, likewise, there was insufficient evidence presented to find that either of the building's management agents or its owners had reason to believe that Pilko was a dangerous person who should not have been allowed to work at the premises. And I think this just goes to show, like, how horrible the time period was after her death. It was one of confusion, anger, sadness. And then also, you have to throw in this incredible joy that was happening after she died. Waitress was accepted to the Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah.
And she never knew that it was accepted. And it premiered there just 3 months after her murder. The pictures of Andy at Sundance are harrowing. He looks like he has aged 20 years in 3 months. He is just, he looks crazy.
He's like, distraught.
He's distraught. The movie released to rave reviews, won many awards at film festivals across the U.S. When the film ended at Sundance, people stood up and they applauded, like standing ovation, like so emotional. And like, obviously, like the cast is there, like fucking Felicity's there.
Yeah.
Keri Russell. And she is like so, because like this was not just her co-star. It was the writer and the director of the film. Like, this was someone who, like, this film was her.
This was, she was the artist that made the film happen.
Exactly. But the film was a success. The film was produced on a budget of just $1.5 million, and it earned over $23 million in the global box office. So the film was a huge success at Sundance, obviously. And Andy made sure that Adrian was there in some way to see it happen. He took a small vial of her ashes and he held it while they watched the movie. And he went out in the streets and he sprinkled her ashes in the road at Sundance. And he said when he like, he would just kind of like pick up her ashes and like toss them little places. So she would be everywhere during the whole experience. And he said at one point he picked up a little and tossed it up and a little bit landed on the shoulders of Harvey Weinstein. And he looked very irritated. And he said it felt like Adrian was right next to me laughing that she had got one over on this fucking asshole.
You got my body on you now, baby.
So because this was an indie film, it became sort of a cult classic for years with a small but very loyal following. That is until 2015 when a musical adaptation of the movie debuted with music and lyrics written by Sarah Bareilles. And the play was the musical was directed by another woman, Diane Paulus. The musical was a smash hit. And a few years ago, I saw the touring production of this show at the Hippodrome here in Baltimore, and it blew me away. The songs are so good. I still listen to some of them every week because they are on my running playlist. And if you have a minute, please do watch Jesse Mueller, who originated the role of Jenna, sing the song She Used to Be Mine at the Tonys. It makes me ugly cry every single time. Jesse said that whenever things got tough, which they often do when you are doing 8 shows a week on Broadway, doing a very emotional role
at forever,
she would look at a post-it that she stuck to her mirror, which said, "It's for Adrian."
Adrian! I had to do it. I'm sorry.
Her husband, Andy, has also preserved her memory by building a garden in her name and establishing the Adrian Shelley Foundation. This is a nonprofit organization that awards scholarships, production grants, finishing funds, and living stipends through its partnerships with academic and filmmaking institutions. Fun fact, the foundation gave an early short film grant to Chloe Zhao, who 8 years later would become the second woman in history to win the Academy Award for Best Director. And as a part of its annual awards, the Women Film Critics Circle gives the Adrian Shelley Award to the film that most passionately opposes violence against women. In 2021, Andy Ostroy, still trying to make sense of losing his person, made a documentary about his late wife called Adrian. And the film is made up of so much footage of her and her early life and her career and making Waitress and all of these things. And he also interviews Diego in prison.
I absolutely hate that.
It was so hard to watch because Diego, like, this is not excusing anything he did. He was also like 19, and like, I hope that this is genuine. It seems very genuine from my point of view. He like feels so terrible. He tells him, he goes, "I was not a violent person." He goes, "I never thought I would do something like that." And like, and he just keeps saying like, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." And like, Andy like was like, "Well, I just want to show you." And he's showing pictures of like Sophie riding a bike. And he's like, "She missed this." just like all these things. And it's like, oh my gosh, like this is so, it is gut wrenching because like Andy needs to say it like, and I don't like, he just needed to get it out.
He needed to unload on him.
Yeah. And he told him, he goes, I'm not here to kill you. But yeah, it is just such an emotional experience, and it's an emotional film just watching the people that loved her so much talk about her and her potential. Andy said, Adrian was the kindest, warmest, most loving, generous person I knew. She was incredibly smart, funny, and talented, a bright light with an infectious laugh and a huge smile that radiated inner and outer beauty. She was my best friend and the person with whom I was supposed to grow old with.
That's so sad. Match.com, you did it.
You did it again, you bitch. He didn't get the chance to grow old with Adrian, but thanks to him and plenty of other talented people, her work will live on, and so will the spirit that she evoked through her work. And I think she would be so proud to know how many people see her musical and connect with this woman who is scared shitless to have a kid, who is trapped in an abusive relationship. And also, like, there's a really great song in the musical about how, like, she's like, I used to bake pies with my mom, and like, my dad was abusive, and like, that was our escape, was us baking pies in the kitchen. And just like, the strength to like end that generational trauma and like create something beautiful. And if you haven't seen it, you just have to watch it. It's so good. And like the main kind of thing I got from it was like everyone in the musical and the movie is so afraid to really love and be loved, because it really highlights the vulnerable nature of it. And
well, it's scary to love because you're making yourself available to loss, which is like what happened to Andy in this story.
Yeah, exactly. And to Sophie, you know, she was 2 years old when her mom died, and she looks so much like Adrian.
Oh,
so you're watching her and she's reading her words, and you know, and you can see kind of how it's affected her. Like, Andy will ask her, he was like, so like, when was the last time you cried? She was like, oh, years. She was like, I really try not to. Like, you know, I think there's just such a loss that like she has created like her own boundaries around it. And like, and it's hard. And like, and that was, I think, why Andy wanted to make the film too, is he was like, I want her to know her mom on a deeper level. So anyways, I don't know. That's Adrian Shelley.
What a crazy story. Wow. Why do you start us off so depressing?
I should have gone second. I had the dessert. I had the sad story.
Should
have gone second. Anyways, we're going to get more drinks and we'll be right back with another story.
Wow. So long. Where exactly was the video? Will be the question.
Okay.
We're back, second half, much like happier half.
Good,
I mean, there's a lot of negativity in this half. Don't get me wrong, okay, but it's not as tragic.
Yeah.
So we're talking about Margaret Keane. Do you want to know what you're drinking?
I do.
This is called Big Eyes, and I tried desperately at the store today to find googly eyes to put on this cocktail, but could not find it. So
terrible.
I know, it's really sad. So if you have googly eyes, please add them to your cocktail. Maybe we'll do it in post on the
Well, you know what's funny is
picture.
Casey's mother gave his brother and sister-in-law just a giant pack of googly eyes for the kids. And Ro likes to keep a fairly like tidy, clean house.
Tight house. A tight,
they
tight house.
They are everywhere. There are googly eyes on everything. And I, God, it's so crazy. And I was like, oh, Miss Debbie. I don't know if this is the right gift.
No, for real.
This household.
Yeah, not quite clean.
But I love it.
So
I enjoy the googly eyes over there.
Yeah, I like them on everything, honestly. Open my fridge, googly eyes. This cocktail's called Big Eyes.
Perfect.
And it is black raspberries muddled, a little bit of simple syrup, gin, and then like tonic water. It is a strong cocktail.
Okay.
But it's like a cocktail, you know? It's right. not like sweet or yeah. anything like that. The only thing sweet in it really is the raspberries.
Right. Mmm. It tastes like a very light shade of pink lipstick.
Okay.
Like, not in a bad way.
No, I know what you mean. It's, yeah. it's kind of floral a little bit.
Yeah. But just like very, like there's no, like, the gin is nice because, like, you do, like,
taste
that,
it.
You know, rather it's more than, like martini. A sticky sweet. Yes.
Martini-style mm-hmm. gin where you're literally tasting the gin. It's yeah. not like a Cosmo.
I will also say this is one of the cocktails that, like, it's, like, I expect it to taste like champagne because it's in a flute.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I've never had this before where, like, the glass is making me second guess my taste buds,
it's
which
just phantom champagne.
Phantom champagne.
Yeah, I wanted it to be long and skinny with googly eyes, and so I'm pretty sad about that, but that's okay.
That's right. We'll put them on.
Yeah.
We'll Photoshop it.
We'll figure it. Okay, so what do you know about Margaret Keane?
Okay, so I know that she was an artist, and her thing was painting these paintings with, like, very big eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And I know that her, I believe, shitty husband tried to take credit for her work. And there was, like, a big case about, like, a big trial about it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how the trial came out, but I know that it eventually became a big Hollywood movie. And that's how I know, because, like, you see all that play out in the thing. And I think that she was, like, because she was like, that's how I see the world, you know? Like, I don't know. She just seemed like a really interesting, quirky person that I wanted to know more about.
Yeah, I loved researching her this week. It is, like, obviously there's a lot of sad parts of this story because, you know, patriarchy. Uh-huh. But things go decent, I guess, by the end. So okay. I'm excited to talk about it.
Perfect.
First, I obviously watched Wikipedia. I watched a ton of YouTube videos about this. I read an article called Movie vs. Reality, so I could break down how much reality was in the mm-hmm. biopic. Turns out Tim Burton took 10 years making this film.
Really?
So, like, it was so important to him to get it right, and so much of it's accurate.
Okay.
So
that makes me happy because you do think about, like, a situation that she was in where, like, someone is stealing her creativity,
yeah.
and then you're like, oh, God, I don't want to do the same thing. With
she's in it, too.
Like,
she's in it. There's a cameo.
Really?
She's sitting on a park bench in aww. The background while Amy Adams is acting. So, like, she...
Very Barbie of her.
She, yeah. Oh, my gosh. She had, like, such creative, like, not control of it, but definitely had, like...
Like, influence.
Influence to talk to Tim Burton and tell her story in the way that she wanted it told.
Also, it reminds me of Temple Grandin.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, of, like... I love biopics that are like, come and make this movie with me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
make it more real.
I think that is so important because, like, sometimes movies take big leaps and you're like, that really happened.
Well, it makes you question the rest of the film.
Yes.
When you take one or two huge leaps of uh-huh. faith where it's like, it might make a better picture, but now I don't actually know what happened with that person because I don't know what's real and what's not.
Yeah.
So this one did not do that. So okay. if you watch it, big eyes, it's free on Amazon Prime.
Perfect.
If you have a subscription, obviously.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you have to watch it with ads. Okay. Margaret Keane was born Peggy Doris Hawkins. Some listed, you know, Peggy's the nickname for Margaret, just like my mom, on September 15th.
I would love if she went the other way. She was like, I was born Peggy. I'm going to go by Margaret.
I'm going Margaret from now on. On September 15th, 1927, she was the elder of two children to David and Jesse Hawkins, and they lived in Nashville, Tennessee. When she was 2 years old, her eardrum in one ear was damaged mm-hmm. during an operation, and she was unable to hear properly from it. So she learned to watch people's eyes when they were talking to her to learn to understand them.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So she's 2 years old, and she just, like, focuses on people's eye contact is so important to people in the hard of hearing community.
I didn't know that. That's very interesting. I also feel like this is, like, an origin story, you know,
it's
of, like,
cool.
Then you're like, oh, it all makes sense.
Yeah. I was actually watching part of season 7, Somebody Feed Phil, and he went to Washington, D.C., and there's a restaurant in Washington, D.C. that all the people cooking and serving and hosting and bussing there are all hard of hearing or deaf
huh.
or people that are deaf. And the head chef was signing with them at the table about how it's so hard to work in a kitchen because eye contact is so important in the hard of hearing community.
Right. And but you also have to be making eye contact with like the flames and the food
and not running into somebody with a hot pan. Like there's so much going on.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's funny. My close friends and I, we had a cooking party recently, and like there were so many times where like we're all cooking in this kitchen together and we're like behind.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I do it all
behind
the time.
Hot.
I do it in the kitchen constantly to my kids. Behind.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. It's perfect.
Oh my gosh.
Especially so we have a swing door, and usually there's an in and out door in a kitchen, but we have one swing door. So I'm always like coming through.
I love it.
Okay.
I love that because we did not do that. We almost ran into producer while we made the second cocktail.
Really should have. He like froze. He knew it was happening. So she and her older brother, David, they went to public schools in Tennessee. Peggy started drawing as a child. And at the age of 10, she took classes at the Watkins Institute in Nashville. This is an art and design college that offers art programs for the community. So
oh,
she's
cool.
10 years old, like taking her art classes. She loved drawing, and especially doodling eyes were of interest to her from a very young age. And I think a lot of artists do this, hands, eyes, you know, things that are difficult to capture correctly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the first oil painting that she ever created was at the age of 10 while she's taking this class. And it's of two girls. One is crying and one is laughing. And she gives it to her grandmother. Mm-hmm. When she was 18, she attended a design school in New York City for 1 year. And after taking art classes in both Tennessee and New York, Margaret married for the first time to a man named Frank Albrecht. The two had a daughter named Jane, but he was not a super supportive dude and kind of emotionally abusive. So Margaret did something that women did not do in the 1950s. She got a divorce.
Wow.
She takes her daughter and leaves him. So to support herself as a single divorced mother in the 50s, it's very hard to get a job, but she has a talent. So she begins working at like a baby factory painting baby cribs. So you know how like your dad had that baby furniture with like bunnies on it?
Yeah.
That was like her job. She painted the little cute creatures and like the Humpty Dumpty on like the crib.
That's so cool. I love that.
That's how she supported herself and her daughter.
That's really neat.
Margaret, by which she went in her professional life, she never really went by Peggy as an adult. Her art is known as kitschy. Like when you describe it online, it's called kitsch. If you click on the little blue word kitsch, it comes up with the dogs playing cards at the table. So it's not very like highly respected.
I would consider that eclectic.
That picture. Fucking love that picture. I love weird art like that. Who
I
doesn't?
Do too.
It's crazy that people are like, well, is your art Jackson Pollock or nothing?
See, and I do think that that's what's interesting about Kitchen Eclectic, our brand name, is that
password to my bank account.
This is the thing. I think that there is a fine line because eclectic stuff, like there is a ton of kitschy shit in my household.
Yeah.
You know,
but sometimes kitschy stuff becomes eclectic over time.
Mm-hmm. You gotta, or with the right collection.
Yeah. You got to get it in early. You have to have a shelf of oddities,
which I literally do have.
Yes, you do. It's on a ladder. That shelf of oddities?
It is rickety, could come down at any day now.
Kitsch or eclectic?
I often say, I'm like, this is why I cannot have children, because this is a hazard.
Let's pitch this game to my brothers. Kitsch or eclectic?
Oh my gosh, they would fail miserably.
At the game, but we should, let's pitch it tomorrow night.
Okay.
We're going to be like,
Marjorie, is this one for you?
We have the best idea. We have the best idea. Okay. So,
it was really just Katie or Allie.
Who would have this in their home?
Actually, and that'd be a fun thing, is some things would be in the middle of the Venn diagram.
I absolutely agree. Some things are Monstera plants, one might say.
So kitchen eclectic.
So stupid. So she worked in both acrylic and oil paints, with the subjects of her artwork usually being limited to women, children, and like household animals like cats, dogs, horses, very cutesy, things. So Margaret and her daughter, after the divorce, moved to North Beach, California. She's painting cribs. She's doing stuff on the weekends. And in 1955, she meets a man named Walter Keane at an outdoor art fair in San Francisco. She says that she was taken by him when she first met him at this art show. They're both kind of like selling art there or showing their art. She says he was suave, gregarious, and charming, which to me says red flag, red flag, red flag. All the red flags. In his 1983 memoir, The World of Keane, Walter said that Margaret told him she loved his big-eyed paintings and that he was the greatest and most handsome artist she had ever met.
I'm sorry, did AI write that interaction?
I think our sister-in-law wrote
what? That is so dumb.
So
when
dumb.
Have you ever met someone and be like, you're the most wonderful, gorgeous boy I've ever talented.
This is what boys dream of. I think it's what they think. Is this what they want us to say?
As Mariah Carey said, it's a sweet, sweet fantasy, baby. It's never going to happen.
Yeah. Unless you have big dick energy.
But even then, the savvy woman is not going to say.
No, you can't say that.
You can't compliment a man.
His head's already big enough.
Exactly.
Literally and figuratively. I hate myself. Send me home.
Okay.
We hate Walter. Walter had previously been married. We don't hate him because of that. And he had his own daughter, Lily, I believe was her name. So Lily and Jane. He was actually like an aspiring artist who painted, quote, landscapes. He worked as a real estate agent and was considered like a Sunday artist. Like you paint on the weekends and sell your things at shows. Because you have to support yourself. Most artists do that.
Yeah.
Writers, singers, you know, painters, everybody. He constantly spun this story about living in Paris, which he did live in Europe for a little while, and that he studied art there at this famous art school, and he spent a ton of time at the Louvre, and it seems
if you know it.
Yeah. If you've ever heard of it. It seems to me like a lot of it's bullshit. He spent time in Europe, but I think he wished he was doing something he wasn't doing.
Yep.
So the two met in 1955 and are married that same year in Honolulu. He flew her to Hawaii. He was a good real estate agent. He was a good salesman. Flew her to Honolulu. They get married. The movie made it seem like Margaret was getting married because her first husband was trying to say that she was an unfit single parent. But I didn't see that in any other articles. I don't know if that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Her painting style, as we know, is recognized by the oversized doe-like doll eyes of her subjects. She started painting what are now called Keane eyes, which I hate that it's not her maiden name.
That does.
Fucking pisses me off. When she started painting portraits of children, she says the children showed her inner person. The eyes of these children, women, animals, were how she was feeling at the time, mm-hmm. whether they're like happy tears, sad tears, etc. Eyes are the window to the soul, she says. And she was a divorced single mom, and she was sad and desperate a lot of the time. And these are the types of paintings that remind me of like the Precious Moments glass figurines. It's like so commercial.
Yep.
It's not something that the critical art world calls art, but it is so likable.
Mm-hmm.
You can't help but like it.
Mm-hmm.
Walter swoops in and is like, honey, stay home and paint. Do whatever you have to do. I'm going to go out and sell your art. And remember, he's a real estate agent. He can sell. He's a good salesman.
Mm-hmm.
He's like a used car salesman, I'll say. He takes her big eyes paintings. Unbeknownst to her, though, he ends up claiming it's his work. So he starts by going to this club, The Hungry Eye, and he's hanging up, I think, her paintings and his paintings to sell. He's like renting the walls of the club in San Francisco. The movie makes it seem like there's a misunderstanding, but I think he was just straight up claiming from the beginning that he painted these.
Yep.
He
knew exactly what he was doing from the get-go.
Yes.
Because if he believed in his paintings as much as, like, you know,
her paintings?
Yeah. Then he would only put his up.
Mm-hmm.
Because a man with that kind of ego, you know, if he really believes in, if he he knew what talent she had.
Yeah, he's not an artist.
No.
Not at all. So the paintings are just kind of like wall pieces for a while. They're not getting a lot of notoriety. And then Walter and the club owner get in a fight. And in the midst of this fight, a woman accidentally gets hit in the face. And it makes all over like the news about this, like people fighting about pictures and a woman got hit. So everybody's now coming to the club to see these pictures because it's in all the gossip columns, these paintings. So one night she comes to the club because they start flying off the walls and he's like, paint more, paint more, paint more. People are buying them. And she's like, I want to come and see people buy this art. And she gets there and she realizes, much to her chagrin, that he's selling them as his work. And they just say Keen at the bottom. She said she realized it when somebody came over to the bar and was like, oh, you're Walter's wife. Do you paint too? And she's furious. So when she discovers the lie, the two were only 2 years into their marriage and it was completely happy up to this point. They were still in the honeymoon phase and Walter gave her every sort of excuse. We need the money. People are more likely to buy art if they think they're talking to the artist. People don't want to think they make your wife work for you. People already think I painted them, so now it's confusing. Like, he's got a list.
Because he's a professional salesman.
He's selling her.
Yeah, he's selling her paintings and her, and he's conning the whole fucking thing.
Exactly. She also at the time was extremely shy and timid, so she was like, I'll let him go out to the club and sell my art every night, and I'll stay in and paint. I like painting. It's not a big deal. I also have a young daughter. Jane is there, so she has to be a mom. And then, quote, she says when she's interviewed about it later, back then, women kind of went along with their husbands. We didn't rock the boat. He finally wore me down. While we were fighting this out at home, the paintings were selling. They were flying off the walls. Posters were selling. It was unbelievable. It snowballed overnight. It kept getting deeper and deeper. I lost respect for him and for myself, and I lived in a nightmare.
Well, it's hard to justify rocking the boat when it's, you know, calm skies ahead. Yeah. You know, it's like, everything is technically fine.
Yeah.
So, like, why would I complain about this? And like, so many of us get into that mindset of, like, things aren't right, but they're not the worst they could be.
They're fine. They're not perfect. Yeah. They're fine. And also, she kept justifying it to herself as, like, as an artist, I'm supposed to care that people like and see my art and not that I'm making money for it, which I have a big problem with people calling the sellout card. Mm-hmm. Like, people don't sell out. They make a living with their art. There are people who sell out. They're the non-talented people that will do whatever a record label wants.
Yeah.
Other people have talent and just know how to sign a contract.
You know, it's so funny. I was listening to an interview with Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about this. And he was like, we made it big. And then so many people from the punk scene were like really mad at us. And he was like, and it made me feel really bad about myself. Mm-hmm. And he was like, but wait, like, I'm making a money doing my art. Like, he's like, it's not like we, like, they were like, you need to change this about your band. He's like, we, as our, like, grungy selves, were, like, selling millions of albums. He's like, and he's like, and it's really hard, like, trying to be like, no, it's okay that, like, we're popular and we're also just doing the same thing we've always done.
People get so crazy about it. And, yeah. In my opinion, in most cases, this is obviously not always true, but in most cases, the people that whine about the sellout thing are not talented enough to get an offer.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Like, Green Day was a crazy, weird punk band, and they did stay grunge.
Yeah.
And yeah, they went a little mainstream, but you have to be heard on the radio.
Yeah.
And, like, to make money. So they just, like, made compromise. That's not, you're just buying food for you and your family.
Right.
Like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, you have to live. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It drives me absolutely bananas when people do that.
Like, do you want me to do the same thing I did when I was 15? Do you want me to keep doing that?
I'm a 45-year-old man, like, with a wife and children.
Also, him and his wife have the best love story ever.
Well,
no, you don't think so?
Well, I was just saying, I'm right here.
Oh. But no, they've been together since they were like you and Jake's age.
Yeah,
like,
little babies.
They've been together forever. And it's so cute. And his son is being accused of sexual violence. And I think he's like really devastated.
I bet.
Like, I raised you better than this.
I bet. I had like a breakdown when Caroline turned 14 this week because I started dating Jake when I was 15. And I'm like, oh my God, like her partner is a foot.
A foot around. As Adrian Shelley said, they're out there.
Out there somewhere. There's only one fish in the sea, as they say.
Classic thing.
So this situation obviously also caused strain in her relationship between her and her daughter, because she used to paint her daughter as part of the portraits, and now she's having to hide her work and like pretend that the stepdad's doing it and like all these different weird things. And she did try to teach Walter how to paint these. He just couldn't do it. Ultimately, she says, I was afraid of him because he threatened me that if I said anything, he'd have me done in. And it wasn't until after his death that I felt comfortable that he wasn't going to kill me for telling the world. In 1957, Walter began really exhibiting, not just in like banks and bars, but he's going to New Orleans and selling this at Mardi Gras. He's at Washington Square Park in New York. He's at the Sheraton Hotel in Chicago. He's at the East Side Gallery, and they're all being sold under his name. And Margaret is just cranking these out at home in this like secret like art studio with little ventilation, as the movie shows it. He also did something a bit revolutionary, though, which actually helped her make her millions. So this is where he actually steps in. They're putting their paintings in galleries, their paintings in galleries. But general people don't go into art galleries and buy $500 pieces. They look at the art. They're like, that's so pretty. You maybe buy one really expensive piece of art in your entire life. So he was like, what if we like sold prints? So he's like the person who made posters, prints, greeting cards, like putting art on like consumer items. So then she's like in the general public and her posters are all over town of her art. And everybody thinks he did it. So she's like annoyed, and the art world is annoyed because they think he's a sellout. And also, like, they're making a ton of cash, so she can't be mad at him because they're making so much money.
This is so interesting.
It's intertwined.
Because, like, it's like, you're like, well, Margaret's not a sellout, but he's a sellout. And, like, yes, like, he is being a dick, but also, like, credit where credit is due. It was a good idea to sell prints. So, like, regular people could have, like, world-class art in their homes. And it's like, there are so many elements to this story.
And it's like, she's not a saleswoman, right? So, like, her art may have never made it anywhere. We may have never seen it if he didn't exist.
Doesn't that suck?
It does suck. Yeah. So it's like, it's important that he existed, but it's also like, he's a shitty person.
He's like the, what is it, like the essential devil?
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like, yes, sure. He is essential to, like, this story existing, but it also doesn't make him less of a devil.
Yeah, he's terrible. Like, so the problem was, when people asked Walter, this problem was happening because they're so famous at this point. It's mm-hmm. everywhere, snowballed. They're like, it's kind of strange that this grown man is painting all these little girls crying with like no reason. And he didn't have anything to say. So he started to develop this myth for interviews that while he was living in Germany and France in the 1940s, he saw these post-war torn cities and these little children fighting over food. And this is, and I quote from an interview, as if goaded by a kind of frantic despair, I sketched these dirty, ragged little victims of the war with their bruised, lacerated minds and bodies, their matted hair and runny noses. Here, my life as a painter began in earnest.
Okay, one jump ahead of the bread line. Calm. That didn't happen.
No.
You. Like, yes, those kids were suffering, but, like, to try and, like, twist it around and profit from, like,
their suffering. Like, suffering, you are like painting children with sad eyes because you saw them once in Europe. You once. Psycho. What a nut.
Okay.
And, I mean, he eventually began these, like, promotions, like, where he would call them the painting keens, like, him and Margaret and Lily and Jane, because then Margaret is like, you know what, I'm going to start painting my own paintings in a totally different style, and she's signing them with her own initials, so then they're doing dual art shows, but it's all her painting. But hers are looking one way and her other her big eyes are looking another way.
This is crazy.
It is. So, huge, big commercial success. They move into a big house. They have an in-ground pool, et cetera, et cetera. The art world hates this guy because they think he's stupid and ridiculous. But he gets commissioned to complete a piece for the New York World Fair. Like the Flushing Meadows, the globe, and like the, you know, like the saucer things that Will Smith climbs up in Men in Black. That's all in like the World Fair space.
Mm-hmm.
So
I mean, we love a World Fair.
Don't we?
Chicago, St. Louis.
We love it. This one is like, okay, they're going to do inside the Education Building, which is the United Nations building. He promises a panoramic, like sized image of like children like walking like towards the forefront of the film, like all these like waif children with these huge like mourning,
they're like the eyes have to be ginormous, just
eyes
to let
just
you know.
Like full like car wheel size eyes of these like bigger even of these kids. It's crazy. UNICEF is like, do it, we'll paint you, it'll be great. It's totally tasteless.
We'll paint you.
We'll pay you. This is totally tasteless. Totally tasteless to put like suffering children in the UNICEF building. Like, I know that that's what they do, but like, nail, head.
Yeah,
like,
right. Yeah.
It's really weird. Mm-hmm. So
it's like, why not put pictures of the actual? I don't know, but also that feels a little exploitative.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's crazy.
I don't know the right answer to this.
It needs to be something more like not kitschy, honestly. Like, I don't know, there could have been a better way to do it, but it was his vision. He comes home to Margaret and it's like, we got this gig. Uh-huh. We're doing it, it's huge, you have 1 month to paint it. 1 month. 1 month. So an art critic sees it as it's like up, it's definitely not finished, she did like a shitty job because she's rushing. 1 month to paint a massive mural all by herself with all these different children and features and eyes and oil paints, whatever. The art critic says, for grinding out formula pictures of wide-eyed children of such appalling sentimentality that his product has become synonymous with critics' definition of a tasteless hack work. The painting contains about 100 children and hence is about 100 times as bad as the average Keen. He hates Keen paintings, obviously. But she's reading all this criticism and it's pointed towards her. And then the people at the World Fair are like, yeah, we're not going to put this up.
Oh, they didn't put it up.
No. They decided to pull it from display.
Well, and it sucks because that one like wasn't even totally his fault because they gave her a month. Like,
and
it's not enough time.
And it's like his vision. He's like, I want all these kids walking forward. I don't think that
like
that's
she
how she paints.
Yes.
Yeah. He was just like, this is what you have to paint. She at this point was like,
she's a factory at this
right.
point.
She's just producing. And he is the idea man. And that's when art loses its soul.
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. that's when you sell out, when yes. like the ideas aren't there anymore.
Yeah.
So after this, Walter becomes very aggressive towards her and her daughter. He starts threatening them that he's going to kill them if they tell anyone. He starts yelling at her that why isn't she a better painter? And she asks for a divorce. And he says, I'm going to grant you a divorce on a stipulation that you sign a contract that you will produce more paintings for me afterwards. So like, she's like, fine, whatever. I don't give a shit. She wants to get away and get herself safe, get her daughter safe. So she signs on that she is going to get a divorce and produce paintings for him post-divorce just to keep him off her back. They had been married for 10 years.
10 years?
They had been married for 10 years.
Oh, my gosh.
After their marriage, she did, in fact, produce for him over 20 to 30 paintings and send them to him. Far distance, too, because her and her daughter moved to Hawaii. They were like, get us out of here. Get us out of here. Margaret in Hawaii meets her third husband about 5 years later. He was a Honolulu sports writer named Dan McGuire. She credits him with helping her be less timid and afraid after her divorce from Walter. Margaret and her daughter also became Jehovah's Witnesses while in Hawaii. Okay. So they found a community of people and friends that like they just wanted to be with. So in 1970... this is about the time that she is married to her new third husband. been living in Hawaii for about 5 years away from Walter. She gets on a radio interview in Hawaii and announced that she was the real creator of the paintings and that they had been attributed to her ex-husband, Walter Keane. And of course, this goes wild, this media story, because he's so famous. Yeah. After Margaret revealed the truth, there's a paint-off scheduled in San Francisco Union Square. They arrange, the reporters from the San Francisco Examiner arrange this. Margaret shows up to paint. Walter does not even show up. And then in 1986, she decides to sue Walter and USA Today in federal court for an article claiming that Walter was the real artist. He's being sued for defamation of her character, and USA Today is being sued for libel. Because Margaret claimed on multiple occasions that Walter had painted the paintings, USA Today was acquitted of libel. Like, they couldn't get in trouble for that, because for 10 years she was like, yeah, they're his.
Backing him up.
Yeah, for 10 years. So they're like, well, of course, that, like, we thought the source was credible. But then Walter was, like, going into this court case with USA Today, but then they're acquitted. So Walter's kind of left lawyerless, and he's like, I'll just defend myself.
That's always a good idea.
Everyone
loves that.
You know what I say to people when they have to go to court? Defend yourself.
Yeah, it worked out well for Ted Bundy. So it'll do wonders for you.
It'll do wonders for really anyone. So at the trial, the judge famously orders Margaret and Walter to each create a big-eyed painting in front of the jury to determine who's telling the truth.
God, I love this.
They had 1 hour to create the painting, and he said his shoulder was sore, and he couldn't do it. Margaret completed her painting in 53 minutes and got to sign her work with her own name.
I love that.
So the movie did make it seem like the court proceedings were, like, in and out in one afternoon. But we know that court proceedings take weeks, and then there's years and years of appeals. So the initial court case was 3 weeks, and she was awarded ownership of her work and $4 million in damages. Margaret said, I really feel that justice has triumphed. It's been worth it, even if I don't see any of the $4 million. She doesn't care about the money.
Yeah.
She doesn't care. She never did.
Yeah.
A federal appeals court upheld the verdict of defamation in 1990, but overturned the $4 million because Walter is literally broke. He has nothing. He's married again. He's living in England or something. Like, he's gone. He's an idiot. Margaret said she didn't care at all about the fact that they drop the him having to pay her. She's like, I just want the defamation, like, verdict to stand, which it does. The artwork Margaret created while living in the shadow of her husband tended to depict really sad-looking, dark children with sad, sad eyes. But after she left Walter and moved to Hawaii with her daughter and became a Jehovah's Witness and did all the fun things she wanted to do, all of her kids start to look much happier and brighter. And the women that she's painting with big eyes are holding glasses of wine. Aww. And they're holding flowers. And it's just, like, really nice to look at. And she starts to get calls from very famous people to make portraits of them. Actors like Joan Crawford, Zsa Gabor, Dean Martin, Helena Bonham Carter, Natalie Wood, Jerry Lewis. She's painting all of their portraits. And of course, in 1990, Tim Burton, a major big eye art collector, as we can tell from all of his movies, his little creepy characters all have these huge fucking eyes.
Yep.
He commissioned her to paint a portrait of his then girlfriend, Lisa Marie.
She Presley? Lived,
I don't know if he dated Lisa Marie Presley. Oh. It just said Lisa Marie online.
Oh, okay.
Awesome. I mean, that's the right that's the right circle and age range. We'll have to Google that off air.
She lived, find that on Patreon.
Everybody else, just Google it right now. She lived in Hawaii for more than 25 years before returning to California in 1991. She and her daughter Jane and her son-in-law Don resided in Napa County. In 1992, she opened her own Keane Gallery in San Francisco, and she also started the Keane Foundation, which introduces art to children. Her big eyes paintings have influenced cartoon and toy design around the world. Little Miss No Name, Susie Sad Eyes, Bratz Dolls, The Powerpuff Girls, Puss in Boots from Shrek, the new Tangled by Disney. All of these fucking stuffed animals that my daughter has.
Allie is showing a puppy T-Y.
A Beanie Boo. The Beanie Boos have the huge eyes.
Is that what they're called?
Beanie these Boos? Ones with the big plastic eyes are Beanie Boos. I brought them down to remind us that, like, because of her, the way that we depict eyeballs is different. And, like, I kind of hate it because all the Disney characters kind of all look the same now with, like, their round faces and their big eyes. But she's the inspiration for that. She is, like, the groundwork for these characters with these huge sad eyes. In media productions, in the comedy film How to Murder Your Wife in 1965, you can see six of her paintings in the background. Then they were thought to be by Walter. She ended up being a character on Powerpuff Girls. They drew her and had her on in 1998.
That's so cool.
I know. Matthew Sweet's album had one of her oil paintings on the cover. And in 2014, Tim Burton made a biopic starring Amy Adams called Big Eyes about the court case and her marriage to Walter. Margaret makes an appearance in the film as an old woman on a park bench. She turned down before this various offers to film. She didn't want it. But after meeting with Tim's team of screenwriters and production assistants, she agreed. And as I said, the film took over 10 years in development for completion. Her ex-husband held through on this lie through his death in the year 2000. But if you look at his Wikipedia shortlist right underneath his name in the box, it says known for plagiarism. Which, when I went on his page today just to, like, read what it said about her, and when I saw that, I was like, this is perfect.
That's really good.
In 2017, at the age of, I think, 90, Margaret began hospice care while living in her home. The additional care that she received through hospice allowed her to recover enough to live for a couple more years and to relax and to paint. And she did. She was painting and creating well into her 80s and 90s. She died from heart failure at her home in Napa on June 26, 2022, so just 2 years ago, at the age of 94. In regards to her critical versus commercial success, Andy Warhol was very frustrated, and he said, "I think what Keane has done is just terrific. It has to be good. If it were bad, so many people wouldn't like it." And that is the story of Margaret Keane.
Oh, what a wild story.
I can't believe it.
I can't believe it either. God, what a great get on an ex-husband.
The best get. The best get. Maybe if she could do that.
I'm going to ruin your Wikipedia forever.
His Wikipedia.
The ultimate revenge.
Known for plagiarism. That's perfect to me.
All right. Well, we need to talk about these two women together in a little segment we like to call Just the Two.
Okay. So you started your description as doe eyes.
I can't.
Off the top, Katie, off the top.
What's funny, because, like, I wrote that, and I knew that Margaret's story was focused around eyes, and I didn't even make the connection.
Yeah, as soon as you wrote, I was like, I am writing this down. So I think the primary thing in both of these stories is women not being safe in their own home. It was very shocking to me that it's two very different types of attacks. One is from a stranger. Mm-hmm. It is a random act of violence. It should have never happened.
Yeah.
And one is an emotional / threatening physical abuse in a domestic relationship. And you, as a woman, should never have to feel in danger in your own home.
No, you shouldn't. And it is, like, so frustrating that, like, both of these stories had that, like, internal element, because it also makes you feel unsafe from everything, because you're like, man, it could be a stranger or it could be someone that I literally chose to marry. Like, it feels terrible. And I don't know. I saw a lot of connection between the two, and that they were both artists, and they were both very, like, personal artists. They, as much as, like, you know, you could say that, like, Margaret was, like, churning out works like a factory, it didn't make it any less personal. Like, she is still doing stuff that, like, came from her heart. And, like, as much as you want to say, like, that Adrian was, like, just doing a ton of films because she wanted to make money, like, you know, like, she's doing small indie projects for a reason, mm-hmm. you know. And she also stopped doing other people's projects because she was like, it didn't feel as personal, you know. And I feel like they both had that breakthrough at some point in their career where they're like, oh, wait, like, this isn't what I envisioned. Like, I think they both had that moment of like, oh, no, like, my personal artistic vision is worth more than I'm giving it credit for.
Absolutely. And also the fact, too, that like they, in their vision, they became these weird overnight successes when they finally like dove into what they wanted to do and what they were good at. Like, their careers snowballed around them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For Adrian in a really like positive and helpful way. Yeah. And for Margaret in a way that almost felt suffocating because she couldn't even claim her own work.
Yeah. And it's hard when you have to, like, there's no doubt in anyone's mind that like Adrian did what she did. And I was getting really frustrated in Margaret's story because she literally had to go in front of a jury in a legal trial. And like, and for some other places too. And like, prove that like that was her artwork. And like, I was thinking, like, you said in the very beginning that, like, she had made an early portrait of, like, you know, people with doe eyes for, like, her grandmother. And I was like, I wonder if she's going to have to, like, bring that into, like, court and be like, I have been doing this since I was a child. Like,
yeah,
this is just my thing.
Well, it's one of the things that she, like, asked Walter in the movie, like, where's your concept sketches? Where's all the work that goes into making something like this? Because you don't fucking have it.
Yep.
I highly suggest watching this movie. It's a
very
good movie. It's like worthy of a Friday, Saturday night flick, like on the couch.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very good.
Excellent.
Yeah, I find that I was frustrated really for both of them in the idea that you said truth moves slower than fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in your story, Andy is frustrated that truth is moving slower than fiction because he was in a loving, compassionate relationship. Yeah. And in my story, Margaret is frustrated because she is literally prevented from telling the truth because she's not in a loving relationship. So your partner plays a big role in how you're presented to the world. And Andy was willing to fight for Adrian.
Yeah. And I also was thinking about a lot of how Margaret reminded me a lot of the character of Jenna from Waitress. And like, I think that there is a deep part in Adrian that was like so grateful for the relationship that she had, but she also had been dating in New York for nearly 20 years and was like, I know that this is rare. I know that, like, I know what it feels like to date someone who doesn't value you.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many scenes in the play and in the movie where, like, you know, she comes home from working all day and like Jenna's husband is like, all right, fork it over, like, where's the cash? And like literally makes her like count out the bills for him,
the
and
tip
like
money,
the tip money, and like he takes everything from her. And I kind of, and it's like, so Adrian knows what it's like to have someone just like suck you dry, and that's what was happening to Margaret. And like, then I think, too, about, like, Margaret did eventually find her happiness, and, like, so did Adrian. And, like, they both just knew the loss and then were able to create from it and do these incredible things. It's just that, like, I don't know. I think about all the good things that Adrian could have done if she had lived longer.
Yeah.
And, like, it makes me so upset.
Well, both their stories were all also, like, had these crushing court cases like involved in them.
Yeah.
Like, that is such a huge marker that like something is going on that's legally inappropriate.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, it's funny. Your case kind of doubled down on why maybe Adrian's family didn't want to getting dragged into a court case. Cause like there was a literal movie made of just the court case of her story.
Yeah.
And I think that Adrian's family was like, we don't want to do that. We want it to be over and done with. And I think that that was...
Well, I think, too, you get evidence, you get photos of the body, you get put all over the internet. Like, never think good of the media and people's bloodthirst for just true crime.
Yeah.
It is unsatiable. Insatiable? Yeah. Insatiable.
Insatiable, I think. I don't know. But, yeah, I'm thinking about, like, they didn't want... Because, like, obviously there are crime scene photos. And, like, the idea that, like, your wife's staged suicide would be, like, put upon these like jury members, and like it's too painful. And I think it's okay to step away from things that are too painful. And I also think it's okay to lean into things that are too painful. Like, there has to be some sort of give and take with it. It's like Adrian's family chose to step away from that a little bit and then like go into it later with like Andy made his own piece of artwork.
Right.
Talking about it in this film. He could have just walked away and not done it. He didn't have to go and talk to Diego in prison. He didn't have to do that, but no. He needed to.
And he wanted to add it as a part of his film because his wife was an artist.
Yeah.
And you tell all the sides of the story.
Yep.
Dramatic.
Yeah. And he like, I don't know. And I think too about Margaret, like she could have lived her life and been like, all right, I got this money or whatever from this. And I'm happy. I'm in Hawaii. But she chose to go into the pain, which is, that's such a hard choice.
And it says a lot about her partner from Hawaii, too.
Yeah.
That, like, he was like, no, you are better. You did do that. Like,
well, I think he's an Andy.
Yeah. Own your work. Own your life. Like, go take it back.
Yeah. Like, I love that Andy had the wherewithal to be like, oh, yeah, like, she's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
She, like, has her own separate whole space to create because like he believed in her so much. He's like, yes, like you need that. And like, and it's so sad. Like there's something so brutal to me about the fact that like the space where she was supposed to feel safe and create and get all of her thoughts and ideas out is the place where she was murdered. Like I hate that. And then it's interesting too, because you were talking about how stifling the studio that Margaret was in felt because it was not well ventilated. She's literally being treated like a factory.
She's hiding paintings. It from her She's daughter. Hiding.
And like mothers and daughters is such a big thing, you know, of like now it's like Sophie is growing up in a world without her mother because someone took that away. And like someone almost took Margaret away. It's like she was nearly crushed by this experience.
Mm.
And like I just love that she like kept fighting because like it does mean so much to your kids when you fight for yourself. It's like, we want women to be so selfless and like whatever. And it's like, no, it's like kids want to see their parents fight for themselves. Like,
yeah, they stand up.
Yeah. And like fight for them, fight for themselves. And I just think that they were both such strong figures in their kids' lives.
I agree.
All right.
I'm ready to toast.
Let's do it. Who would you like to toast this evening?
I want to toast women who are still finding themselves and changing their minds. I think that it's okay to agree to something and then decide later that it's not okay.
Yeah.
I think Margaret agreed to something as a 1950s housewife and then lived through second wave feminism and decided that she was swindled.
Yeah.
And that's so brave to say that you fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
And like you, it makes you seem so weak in the public, but like she went and took her name back, even though she still has to have his maiden name, which is fucking stupid. Whatever. Bye.
I am going to toast the woman who sees their fears and creates something beautiful. Like, I love that Waitress is this homage to being scared as shit to have a kid because it is such a scary.
Fucking terrifying.
It's terrifying. And like I've never had one, but I'm just currently living in constant fear that I'm going to have one.
Hey, birth control's over the counter now. Do you
over
see
the
it?
The counter.
Woo! Life-changing. Life-changing.
And I just think that like it's wonderful to take that fear, to seize it, and then to create something lasting that women still are connecting with today.
Yeah, because even people who want babies are terrified of babies.
Oh, they're so scared. And, like, that's, like, the hard thing, too, is I feel like...
You can be joyous and scared.
Yes, because, like, sometimes I think about women who, like, have fertility issues, and then they try so hard to get pregnant, and then they're pregnant, and then they feel like they're not allowed to be afraid. And it's like... No, you're still allowed to be fucking scared shitless. Like,
I miscarried twice, and then I had a baby, and she was terrible, and I really thought I wasn't allowed to complain.
Yeah.
Like, it's terrifying to complain at that point.
Yeah.
Ugh. Okay.
So, all right.
So now we're doing promos?
Yes. What are you enjoying in pop culture this week?
Well, this is very fitting for tonight, and I did not plan this ahead. I just literally watched this with Eliza and producer. So we on Sunday morning sit in bed together and like watch some sort of documentary. So there's a 3-part docuseries called American Nightmare. Have you seen it?
I know the story though.
Okay. It's so good. It is so good. So, and they do such a great job gone girling you in the story. So the first episode, you absolutely think the male partner did it. The second episode, you absolutely think the female partner did it. And the third episode, you figure out who did it.
Criminal, the podcast, did a 2-part episode on this.
Katie, you need to watch this documentary.
I listen to podcasts all the time. When I listened to this for the first time, this story, my heart was beating out of my chest because it is so, the story is so crazy.
It's unbelievable. So we're watching it unfold and we're doing it one episode at a time via one a week. So like,
oh my gosh,
because
so
that's how we do
opinions
it.
All week.
All week we have these opinions. We do it like episodically. So it's like so fun and we're just like talking about it. And of course Eliza doesn't know the like what to be gone girled means. So then we're like, okay, you have to read this book in the meantime.
Some homework.
And then we have to watch a movie.
For our relaxing Sunday morning.
There's so much to happen here. So it's just an absolute gut wrenching, heart pumping story that I highly recommend on Netflix.
Perfect.
American Nightmare. What do you got?
I'm going to recommend all the waitress things. I'm going to recommend the original movie with Carrie Russell and Adrian Shelley and Cheryl Hines. And I am going to recommend the musical. The musical is so good. And again, it's like the song She Used to Be Mine is like, it is so gut-wrenching. And like, I don't know. I just like, the whole musical is so good. Sarah Bareilles did such a great job with the music and the lyrics. Like, she just fucking nailed it. And I love her.
Good.
So, yeah. All
everybody,
waitress. Go see it. It's
do
fantastic.
It.
All right.
Find us everywhere. Love us everywhere. Find us on Patreon, all the socials. It's Women's History Month. So if you go to my personal page, I got lots of pictures of my kids being famous ladies.
And we can't wait to see you next week. We're going to have another great episode for you. And then Allie will be in Louisiana.
Yeah, I will.
So we're going to have a couple just like really tiny 1-week breaks. But don't worry. We'll be right back here because we know and you know that well-behaved women
have just as hard a time dealing with the men in their lives as non-well-behaved women. However,
they don't say anything. Oh, and well-behaved women rarely make history. Yeah.
Everybody's dealing with men, but only half of them are making history.
Yes. Goodbye.
Goodbye. You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.